Every lap in under a minute means every second matters. Bosch Power Tools Perth Super Sprint, May 17 to 19. Book now at Ticketek. Supercars, unforgettable.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
A Motorsport Podcast Network production.
Hey everybody, welcome along. Great to have you with me for another week. Aaron Noonan here with the V8 Sleuth podcast powered by Castrol for 2024. Now, we've had some great guests on this show over the years, and this week's part one of a two-parter chat with a guy that I've known, I figure, for just over 20 years. Phil Key has been part of the Supercars furniture since 2003 when he arrived at what was then known as Team Brock to engineer Jason Bright, the Keys wheel-owned two-car Commodore team. But before Phil joined the V8 circus, he'd cut his teeth with a legend of the game in Colin Bond and chased the local and world rallying scene firstly with Mitsubishi Rally Art and then with the Subaru World Rally Team, of course run by Pro Drive in the UK. He's worked with world champ Tommy Macadon among many other world rally stars and has got amazing insight into competition on both bitumen and dirt. These days, he's engineering Bryce Fullwood in the Midis Camaro for Brad Jones Racing in the Repco Supercars Championship. But there's so much more to talk with him about. But, this is a big but. Before we start, I need you to do us a favour. Now, every Tuesday, the Motorsport News Podcast is live, and you can get it on the platform where you're listening to this pod. So just search for it, subscribe to both pods via your favourite podcast app, and you'll get notified whenever a new episode goes live. We've also added the Brad Jones Racing Rundown pod to our MN pod offering this year, so we'll have to find a way to get Phil on that one as well as the Special Stages Rally Sport Magazine podcast, which he would probably also qualify to get onto that pod as well. So for all the latest on dirt, bitumen, it's all part of our commitment at the Motorsport Podcast Network to giving you more motorsport in your ears more often. So with Phil Keed, we've kind of got a melting pot of all of those things. BJR, rallying, all things Sleuth. So settle in and enjoy this one. Phil Keed, part one on the V8 Sleuth podcast, powered by Castrol. Phil Keed, hello and welcome to the V8 Sleuth podcast. It's good to catch up with you, mate. We've got a bit of ground to cover. Are you a little nervous heading into this? Are we going back over some stuff that you haven't thought about for a while?
We are. I am a little nervous, actually, but great to chat again, Noons. It's been a long time since we hung up back in those old days. A little nervous.
You'll be fine. We'll go gentle on you. I guess there's over 20 years of V8 Supercar stuff to discuss with you. You've been at various teams, worked with lots of different drivers, had a bunch of success. But if we go way back in the day, and it's not that far back, you're not that old, but where did your motorsport thing kick in? When did the bug actually bite? And how did it get you in?
I mean, it goes back really quite a long way. My dad was really passionate about motorsport, not particularly involved. I think he might have done a few little sprints and things, but just a really passionate fan. And that gave me the bug. You know, he sort of used to talk about Bathurst and things. I never went with him, but we used to go out to Amaru Park and watch the racing out there. And, you know, so that really started it for me. I probably, you know, 8, 9, 10. He died when I was 13. But that got me right into it.
And were you into it as I want to go and be a racing driver, or just like the scene? I love the sounds. I love the whole vibe of it all. What did you see yourself being as what hooked you in, and what part of it was what hooked you in?
I mean, I think everybody at some level starts off wanting to be a racing driver. It's the focus of it. You know, they execute, and that's the big thing. But, you know, from the very beginning, you know, I enjoyed watching, but I always had this sense of wanting to be part of it and be more involved. You know, I used to sort of go out to, you know, maybe 13 or 14, you know, my mum used to take me out there then, and used to go home and just think about, you know, the crews heading off in their trucks. You know, I just was fascinated and passionate about just that whole thing, the whole idea of like, it's this show that just disappears off and what are they up to now, you know? So I guess always from quite young really wanted to be involved.
Did you have a bit of a hero sitting there on the banks at Amaru? Who was the must watch? Who was the star driver, car, team? Who were you all about back in those days?
Well, my dad was a big Ford fan, and so I suppose like everybody then, Dick Johnson was, you know, the current sort of hero at that stage, I guess.
And are we talking hardcore? Are we talking wearing the Shell gear? Are we talking about or are we just liking what we're seeing but just not getting too carried away with it at this point? I'm guessing this is, you know, this is mid-teen sort of period.
Yeah, early mid-teens. I didn't have any of the gear or anything, but I think, you know, we used to go and get autographs, and I think I might have even written Dick a letter and got a reply at some stage,
how good.
You know. So, yeah, I mean, my mum would have that up in her, you know, files somewhere or other. And then obviously just at around, yeah, a little bit older, 15, I think I sort of just rang up. I realised Bondi, Colin Bond, and was still racing Caltech stuff at that stage in the Sierras, and I just rang up the workshop to see if I could get involved about 15.
That's fantastic. So you didn't know anyone at Bondi's team. You just thought, well, they're my local team. I'll give them a call and see if there's a chance.
Well, I grew up in Sydney, you know, sort of Chatswood area, and I realised that their shop was just over in Gladesville, which is really not too far from me. So, yeah, I can't remember how I got the number. I looked them up, or, you know, it was Yellow Pages or whatever it was back then. There's no internet. And it just cold called the workshop and ended up talking to Mick Mitchell, who's, you know, been around forever, one of the lovely guys that was working there at the time, and you know, naively asked for Bondi because I assumed he just sort of was at the shop all of the time. And anyway, so Mick went, yep, no worries, you can come in and help us out. So, you know, I trotted off down there.
And are you still at school at this point? Is this just an after school nighttime type thing?
Yeah, definitely. So I think I was in year 9 or maybe year 9 at school, and I used to catch the bus there, came back from school, catch the bus out to with my skateboard out to Gladesville one or two afternoons a week and trot down there, and, you know, just really probably was no help whatsoever, but used to sweep the floor badly, sort nuts and bolts, you know, those sorts of jobs. And then my mum would come and pick me up about 6 or 6.30.
Love it. And that's such a story that so many people that I've spoken to on this pod, and I can identify with it from my start in the sport as well. When you're just young, there's no grand plan. You just love what you see. You want to get involved, and who knows where it might lead to. So you're hanging around Colin Bond's workshop. I mean, he's still a contender at the time. He's still those Caltech Sierras are still in all the touring car rounds, the Amps car series in Sydney, which I'm sure you would have gone to plenty of those rounds as a young bloke. So Bondi, like, this is just such a cool scenario. And, of course, later on there's a link up when you're at Charlie Schwerkopf's team that we'll talk about later. But what a cool scenario. Tell me about Colin Bond, the bloke, when you're rolling in there in the late 80s sweeping the workshop floor.
Yeah, well, I mean, at that time he lived just down in Hunters Hill, which was, you know, 5 minutes away. So he was in and out of the workshop all the time, and, you know, just a lovely guy. Still, you know, really fond of him now, and he comes and always says hello at the track and things. But, you know, he was always in and out of the shop, and, you know, took a bit of an interest in me, was always just really encouraging and helpful. And, you know, the boys used to be my main liaison point there, Mick and Nige and Simon was the other fella there. I used to go out to the races. My mum used to drop me off at Bondi's place down at Hunters Hill, and I'd get a lift out, you know, at Amaru or, you know, when those sort of races were on. So he was always very kind, and Robbie, his lovely wife, very kind to me through that time.
Were you any good at making things go fast, making things clean? Were you any good at anything at this point, or had you identified what you wanted to hone in on?
No, I would say I was terrible, and still am, to be honest. If you speak to most of the mechanics I've worked with, they sort of get very, very twitchy if I pick up the tools. I'm not known for being very good with pack up and unpack of the truck, sweeping, particular weakness. But, you know, I used to just go and help out, I guess, and, you know, give them some laughs at some of the things I did, you know, all those usual pranks. And at that time, I thought I wanted to be, you know, race driver first, but I was smart enough to realize that you sort of needed a backstop at that point. And so I thought I wanted to be a mechanic at that stage because I really, you know, idolized the boys in the shop. They weren't really engineers at that time. There were ECUs and things, but they had one fellow, lovely guy, used to come out and sort of work the ECU and things, ran a sort of a trucking company. But I didn't really have any sort of role models there from the engineering side of things. So yeah, I wanted to be a mechanic at that stage.
So you said before about watching racing as a younger guy, and so is it right that I'm remembering that your first time actually going to Bathurst isn't to just be a kid on the hill? You're actually with Bondi's team the year that he and Alan Jones finished third on the podium. Is that my recollection? Is that right?
Correct.
That's awesome.
I think it was
88. It was 88.
Yeah, 88. And, so I think I would have been 15 or possibly 16 at that stage. And you know, I'd been to a couple of Amaru races with them, and I was thrilled when they said I could come along, and I got some kit, you know, to wear. My mum dug out one of those jackets the other day, the black CXD jackets, which I got Alan Jones and Bondi to sign. And so off we went up to Bathurst. I got a lift with one of the boys, and we all stayed in the local policeman's house back in, you know, police constable's house.
What?
Or sergeant, I think he was.
Well,
Bondi was sort of mates with him, so we used to.
Oh, I thought you were in trouble.
Stay at the house. No. We used to stay. He used to put up almost all of the team, which was, you know, a real Bondi trait. He's such a gentleman and a lovely guy. So, you know, everywhere we went, there were always just these mates and various things. And so, yeah, we used to bunk down in the house there.
Saving on the accommodation bill too, just quietly, I'm sure, along the way with such connections, because that's what life's all about. It's about who you know, not what you know. So at this point, where do we start to go into? I know rallying follows, but is this the case where, all right, I'm going to go the engineering pathway here and uni post school? What happened in the next phase?
Actually, yeah, my mum tells the story, much to my frustration. But, you know, as I said, I wanted to be a mechanic, and, you know, I used to tell the boys that. And after a little while, I think when they saw, you know, particularly how bad I was at mechanic type things, you know, I think they all said, you know, young Phil, you really need to go to uni and become an engineer. This is where it's all happening. And they were pretty polite about it, but I think they also realized that I would be a terrible mechanic, which I would, you know, really don't have the strengths and characteristics that you need to be a successful mechanic, I think. So yeah, my poor mum was trying to stop me leaving school at year 10 and going and doing an apprenticeship, and actually the boys out at Bondi's were the catalyst to you know, refocus and stay at school and try and get into engineering and be a race engineer or engineer of some sort. So
it was a good idea. It's worked out pretty well, I think you'd have to agree. Where'd you go, and how, what year sort of period are we talking to? This is late 80s, early 90s, I guess.
Yeah, late 80s, early 90s. So yeah, I sort of just managed to drag myself into engineering degree. I went to Sydney University. At that stage, you know, I sort of was still helping Bondi out, and those guys. So yeah, I went to uni there. I did a fair bit of work and some racing as well. So I was actually a 2-time carryover champion. It took me 6 years to finish the degree. probably more due to application or lack of it than, you know, they're not really being good enough at it. But yeah, I just really packed everything in. I built a little rally car. As you said, my interest sort of switched a little bit more towards rallying. So the guys at Bondi actually introduced me to Bob Riley, who was his old engineer from the very early days, who was running Rally Art Australia at that stage. And so I switched across to helping them out at that time. Also was navigating in an off-road car in the Australian Off-Road Championship with a guy, and or navigating and servicing as well for them. So, yeah, really busy. Had my own little rally car and working various pub jobs and all these other things.
What was the rally car? Go on. You got to admit to it now.
The only one that you could have, Datsun 1600.
I was hoping you were going to say that.
I wish I still had. I mean, I had multiple shells, and it was back in the day where, you know, in the neighbourhood there'd always be some old girl with, you know, the automatic ones were what you wanted because you could fit the bigger gearbox in. You know, it had a different tunnel because it's a bit of – and you'd see the old girl in the one with the plastic still on the door trims and, you know, just see if you could find one up for sale. And they were pretty cheap back then, and so, it's such a fun little car to drive. Mine had no grunt or anything because it was sort of they're Japanese SUs, 1800, so L180 motor and things. But yeah, and I learned to weld badly on it, seam welded it myself. It was a bolt-in cage. So Datto 1600.
I'm laughing and giggling because I know exactly what you mean about the Datsun. The Datsun 1600 of rallying and club motorsport in the last probably 30-odd years, it's kind of what HQ Racing became and excels. It was the thing that everyone had, but it's probably now at the point where there's not many of them that haven't been destroyed, bastardized, pulled apart. The number of bargains out there would be pretty minimal, just quietly, I'm reckoning.
No, you see some beautiful ones, and the prices are really coming up on them now, the ones that are left. I used to love that thing and really put a lot of work into it, did a bit of a dodgy paint job on it. I mean, I was quite proud of it at the time, but it wasn't that great in hindsight. Found some little sponsors which, you know, consisted of a bloke that would fit the tyres for free or, you know, nothing, no actual product, but, you know, some people to put stickers on the car and things. So, yeah, I was pretty excited about that whole thing.
It all makes it happen. It all makes it happen. So Rally Art running the Mitsubishi program. So are we talking ARC stuff here that you're getting involved in?
ARC and Asia Pacific at that time. And they had very close links. You know, they had Doug Stewart there and Bob. And so they had very, very close links with Rally Art Europe, who were, you know, obviously kicking great goals at the time. They had Richard Burns and Kenneth Erickson and later Tommy Mackinnon as well. So they had very good links with them and were sort of an offshoot running Asia Pacific and ARC stuff. And when I sort of started helping them out, they were moving into a little bit of stuff in Indonesia of all places, although that was a little bit further down the track. So, yeah, they were out at Lidcombe out in Sydney.
Every lap in under a minute means every second matters. Bosch Power Tools Perth Super Sprint, May 17 to 19. Book now at Ticketek. Supercars, unforgettable.
So we've got into the sport. We've swept the floors at Bondi's. There's a way in here to get into rallying through Rally Art. Probably when I met you, you first came to V8 Supercars, but you had what, five, 6-odd years in this rallying thing with Rally Art and then time with Pro Drive in the UK with the Subaru World Rally Program. It was a long period that you had in rallying that I don't think a lot of people who know you for your V8 Supercar era stuff would know quite the length and breadth and depth, and that's one of the things I wanted to dive into in this chat. So, I mean, high-level stuff here. It's a fair way up from the Datsun 1600 days doing, you know, Lancers and then Subarus, like some of the iconic rally cars of world and international rallying.
Yeah, it was really cool in hindsight. And I sort of, you know, I mean, short of the original call to Bondi and having a really no awareness of how difficult any of it is to get into, I really, you know, just lucked into most of it and sort of bumbled along, was probably cheerful enough, and people always seemed to help me out. So yeah, the uni stuff with Rally Art, that sort of led to You know, through uni, I was really clear on what I wanted to do, you know, and where engineering hopefully would take me. And Bob Riley there was very, very good. He always used to help me and try and, I guess, rather than just help out with the boys, he'd try and push me into and help me grow in those sort of engineering areas. But I mean, it's tremendously intimidating when you're at uni and when you feel like, even when you leave uni, you feel like you know absolutely nothing and you're no use whatsoever. And Bob kept just giving me little tasks and showing me. He did try to teach me how to use, you know, he was one of the older school engineers, which was, you know, you were almost a fitter and turner as well, you know, in the Wally Story sort of mold. So he, you know, showed me how to use his pride and joy hand lathe and mill and everything. And I don't know, I think I broke off about four or five parting off tools and, you know, you see this great bang and then Bob would appear down there. And so I think he sort of gave up on me as a machinist, a fitter and turner, and focused on more the, you know, computers were a thing by this stage. Email was not really, but computers were. So he, put me upstairs and you know, I used to help the boys with more menial things, of course.
Safer behind the keyboard is probably the way that we should probably look at it from here on in.
Yeah, but Bob, you know, back then, even reasonably early, he would, you know, I don't think I'd left uni yet and started doing a few of the ARC events supporting Ed Ordinsky at that time. I think it was a Gallant at that stage. And, had a brilliant time. Used to just go away for the weekend and, I mean, it was just helping, servicing with the boys and things. And really in rallying that, you've got to learn that stuff. You can't really just turn up with a computer. I mean, it's you know, the technical stuff's important, but it's much more about, you know, keeping the car running and you know, sort of strategizing all of those sorts of things.
And I guess too, they don't have, I mean, different world when you got to WRC, but smaller teams, less people, everyone kind of needs to do more than one single job. Everyone needs to muck in and try to help where they can on the things that perhaps are not their thing to be there to do.
And I mean, you know, rallying quite far until you reach almost the sort of the world level, it's a bit like, you know, motorsport at the club level too. It's made up with a lot of people who are just donating their time. I mean, really, really good people, but they're donating their time. And so it's very different than when you're in that sort of completely corporate environment and everyone's paid by someone else and reports to somebody else. So, you know, learning that sort of stuff, everybody is really just pitching in, you know, and I love that as well, that the passion there, that, you know, there was nobody really sort of work weary and everything else in I found. So that was really good. I guess working with Rally Art, once I finished uni, they Bob offered me a job, which, you know, my first job, so sort of went straight into there. And it was, I guess, rally engineer was my title, and I set about trying to get a bit of design and documentation stuff going on the computer. Computers were still fairly new. Everyone had one, but, you know, it was sort of, well, you know, we're just building into spreadsheets and all this kind of stuff was nowhere near as advanced. So there was an awful lot of, you know, still paper bookkeeping and you know, the flow of everything was still paper pretty much at that stage.
It all did step up and get going. So how does the door open from Rally Art to ProDrive, who, of course, were running and ran for many years the Subaru World Rally Championship program? How does the pathway open there? Is there a Bondi part to all this as well? I'm guessing he's got some contacts from back in the day.
I mean, Bondi has this. There's a recurring theme of Bondi popping up at you know, various points in my career and just sort of making some magic happen. But yeah, I did about 3 years in at Rally Art Australia. You know, loved every minute of it, but really just wanted to, I don't know, just that same thing that got me into motorsport in the first place. I just wanted to know how the next bit worked, you know. And I remember asking Bob about it, and because obviously we had links to Rally Art Europe and everything else. And, you know, to his credit, I think I've been guilty of doing the same to younger people at the time. He's sort of been, oh, it's really hard, you know, it's quite advanced, a lot to learn, you know. Probably be a bit difficult, young Phil. And, you know, maybe some of it, I mean, he told me later that really, you know, needed and wanted me to stay. But, you know, it's like when you're that age, you don't really, you know, it's not one of the higher factors in your mindset, I guess. So we're at Rally Australia after party that year, and Bondi was there. I think even possibly John Dawson Damer, I think, but it was navigating. So he was running the zero car. And we'd been at, I don't know, the Novotel or wherever everyone went for the first bit of the after party. And then he gave me a lift. And I remember hanging onto the roll cage in the back of the of the zero car, because he was still driving it around for some reason. Perhaps this was the presentation onto the after party, whatever it was. Anyway, so I was talking to Bondi, and I must have mentioned in the car that I was really keen to go overseas. Anyway, so the night sort of went on and on and on, and it was, you know, one of those really late nights that we used to have after the rallies. And Bondi at about 1 a.m. grabbed me and just dragged me over, and instantly there's Dave Richards and David Lapworth, who are, you know, I mean, they were royalty at that time. You know, DR's sort of an iconic figure in rallying, and Lappy was the, I don't know, the Ross Brawn of rallying and everything at that stage, you know. So introduced me to, I remember feeling deeply stressed at, you know, the level of intoxication I probably had at that stage, and trying not to make a complete goose of myself. Anyway, you know, I don't think it went too badly, because I actually got a bit of a letter about 2 or 3 weeks later. So this was coming right up towards the end of the year, and I got a letter from the ProDrive customer department, David Campion, who's a lovely fellow there, and he just saying, you know, Lappy passed us your details, said you might be interested, and had, you know, one short conversation. And I mean, I didn't even know how much money it was that they were offering. It was a very small amount of pounds. I just said yes. So, you know, literally, I think it was to turn up in England about 2 or 3 weeks after that for a job as a rally engineer in the ProDrive customer department. So then, yeah, I sort of had to ring some people and find out if it was survivable on that income. And you know, they said they'd put me up in a pub for a few weeks. Booked some flights and sort of, you know, got ready to set off. So that's how it all started there.
It's a classic that after parties can be places where bad things happen. But this was a very good thing happening even after potentially 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 quiet ales. I mean, I love these stories about how doors open and opportunities happen in the most unlikely of circumstances. So you go, here's Bondi again. He's just popping up again and just passing, connecting the dots for people. And there you are on your way to the UK. And it's one of those things, I guess, when, so what year is this? It's 2001.
End of 98. I think this was
end of 98.
Yeah, so that this came up.
You just don't know what you don't know at this stage though. You're going into the next thing. Sounds great. I'm off and running. Dollars, I don't care, whatever. I'll get a plane ticket. I'll stay in a pub. You're off and rolling. I mean, this is an exciting part of whatever career you're in motorsport, because holy heck, you've gone from sweeping a floor at Colin Bond's down the road. Now you're rolling into potentially the biggest and best world rally team and one of the best known, with those iconic cars and, you know, the blue and gold livery. I mean, holy heck, this is big ticket stuff.
No, I know. And you know what? It really was my dream, actually. You know, I would have very happily gone and worked with Rally Art Europe as well. They were amazing guys and really, really great. But I remember, I think it was 97, we were at the Bunnings Power Stage, I think it was, down in south of Perth. And, you know, we were all hanging around because we had ages and our car was, I don't know what number it was, miles down the list. So we had a bit of time and you could sort of sneak across to where that water splash was and Colin's jumps. And so I was sitting on a rock, you know, with everyone else in the bush and watching, and down came Colin and, you know, put it, I don't know, so high in the air on that jump. I mean, everybody's seen it, and, you know, over these giant jumps and then through a water splash. Really iconic moment in that old in that old Impreza. And I just wanted to be part of that team, actually. I really wanted, you know, the colors and the car and just everything about it. So, you know, yet again, I sort of actually, with Bondi's help, you know, found myself heading over to literally the all I wanted to do. You know, it wasn't F1, it wasn't anything. It was just want to work in Subaru in that World Rally team. And I'm a completely naive. Luckily, I think I would have been far more intimidated had I really realized or thought through many of these things. You know, I knew what I wanted very passionately, but I wouldn't say I was planning very much of it at any stage. So just found myself, I think, 3 weeks later, over in the UK, and it was freezing cold and it was dark, and the receptionist from the customer department, you know, I got into the pub when I arrived on the Sunday afternoon. The receptionist from the customer department, Helen, picked me up at, I don't know, 8 a.m. or whatever it was, out the front of the pub, and it was still dark, and drove me into work. So that was the first day.
How long did you stay in the pub for? Were you a long-time pub resident?
I was there for, I think 2 or 3 months, which was about how long they put me up. And it was amazing. I mean, I think I even had a mobile phone. You had to go down to the bar to use the telephone and sit at the bar. And it was one of those ones, there were no pokey machines and no music. And just the locals came in, you know, the local vicar and the farmer. And they would just sit in there like it was somebody's lounge room. There was a little darts tournament and something else, and they set up a bank in there on a Tuesday morning, and the motor registry came there actually on a Wednesday morning or Thursday or whatever it was. And I remember I'd go down to make a phone call, because people used landlines a fair bit back then, and you know, 4 or 5 pints later, stagger back upstairs to my little room. I was in this tiny little thing up this impossibly small stairway. So stayed at the George and Dragon for a little while, and I really needed to move out in the end, because it was, you know, that whole thing of the telephone leading to many pints of beer was just getting a bit much. So, I found an ad on the wall at ProDrive, and there was a local fellow who owned a house in Banbury, and he travelled quite a lot. So he sort of wanted just to fill it with people who were, you know, he found interesting because they were Aussies or Kiwis or whatever. So it actually ended up a little bit of a hub of motorsport people. So it was myself and a fellow that worked at British America Racing or whatever it was called around that time, a Kiwi, another fellow who was in rallying, and actually we had Marty Becton came and lived with us.
Oh yeah.
After
yeah,
a little while. He was also a housemate in there. So yeah, I sort of fell on my feet. It was a great house, and I was away half the year pretty much, but always could come back, and there was a little bit of a something going on back there, so it was really nice.
Do you know how to find the right oil for your car? Now you can find out quickly and easily online, thanks to Castrol's Rego to Oil tool. Simply type in your Rego, select your state, and within seconds you'll know the best Castrol products to unlock the edge of performance in your car. So what's your car best suited to? Just search Rego, the number 2, and oil, and find out.
So at this stage, are you straight into traveling to every event, workshop-based? Who are you working with? Who are the drivers in the team at that point? Who stands out, and what were the standout things?
So it was pretty funny, actually. And again, typical of tending to bite off more than I could chew. So I think I'd put down various things I was familiar with in my CV and, you know, whatever else. And, you know, I had done quite a bit with that Mitsubishi, but we weren't running the car from that basis with the proper factory stuff anyway. So I got there I think on that Monday, and I think on the Wednesday one of the, you know, customer reps, because I mean it was ProDrive customer department at that time was huge. They, you know, they turned over probably 20 cars into the customer world each year, or 15 cars, and you know they were running in championships all over the world. So one of the fellows, Kevin Morris, came in and said, "Oh, I need you to go to a test over in Norway." And I think I'd been skiing once, so I'd barely even seen snow, and definitely not, you know, rally tires or knew anything to do with it whatsoever. So, yeah, I found myself, I think, on the Thursday jetting off to Norway with, I mean, absolutely no idea about any of it. And it was to fix the turbos were failing or something like that. So it was to actually try and make inroads onto this, and this motor I knew nothing about. Snow, we went to a test day, and I mean I'd never seen a snow tire before in my life, or an ice tire. and You know, but I guess if you're open and ask questions, people take pity on you and help out and things like that. So that was with a fellow called Morten Østberg, who was a gentleman driver over in Norway, and we went right up north there, which was amazing, and ended up doing I mustn't have done too bad a job, because I ended up doing that rest of that championship with him. And so that was the first thing there. And then at that time they did, a huge amount of tarmac rallying, actually, so customer rallying. So the Italian championship, the French tarmac championship, there was a one in the Czech Republic and a Hungarian championship as well with various teams. So I did all or most of those championships in that year. Mostly at that stage, there was the odd Impreza, you know, the Group A car, and then mostly were the sort of the 97 World Rally cars, which were really, really cool things, actually. I also did the Greek Rally Championship with a interesting
bloke. Was there a championship you didn't do in this period? It sounds like you've ticked just about every championship known to man.
Well, there were, but only because it physically wasn't possible. So, you know, and I've just made it clear, and I had no ties or anything, so I could, you know, they had a rule back then, I think, where, you know, because they didn't quite warrant the motors, but that, you know, there was a whole rebuild sort of program with the motors. They used to service everything at base, but there had to be an engineer present whenever the car was started, basically. So any testing or anything, basically, you'd have to go over there and be there. So, you know, they'd be just turn up at work, you know, with stuff planned for the week, and they'd just like, yep, got a hire car booked. You need to go off to, I don't know, Italy or somewhere other for a test day. So yeah, I did a lot of championships. So there was also the Madeira Rally Championship, which is this little island off the coast of Africa. So went in and out of there. I also did Possum Born in the ARC, which was really a lot of travel, but you know, absolutely loved that. So, you know, used to do that one. I think that's most of the championships. And then there was the, you know, the odd World Rally event that some of the drivers I was working with happened to do on one-offs and things like that, which was really, if that's where you're trying to go, you really need to have been to some of those rallies before. So, yeah, I think, I don't know, it was probably 200 days I was away that year or something like that. You know, I mean, it's just a fantastic time. I loved the customer environment. You know, they were always really grateful for anything you did, and it was a really, really good place to learn. I loved the, you know, you turned up Italy or somewhere, no Google Maps, no, you know, email, no way, you know, no briefing, basically just this, you got to get from, so I'd literally buy a map at the airport and just drive the hire car to wherever you were supposed to meet them. You know, and there's usually someone that spoke English, but all the mechanics wouldn't, and so, yeah, I mean, I absolutely loved it. Absolutely loved that whole period.
Give us an insight, mate, into the Pro Drive, I guess, empire at the time. I mean, how big are we talking here in terms of people involved, programs, I mean, budgets? Try to paint the picture to our listeners on just how big this operation was. I think sometimes we think of big teams in Australia, but this is a whole nother level, isn't it, really?
Yeah, it was huge. I think there were probably 600 people plus at that point on that ProDrive site in Banbury. They were across all kinds of things. So they had the race team, which did, you know, BTCC at that time, and then were moving into the GT3 stuff. They had quite a big OE sort of a thing where they do, you know, much more closed doors consultancy for big manufacturers and things. They had a really advanced sort of technical group there of really, really strong engineers that would, you know, farm out for whatever it was. There was the World Rally Team was the biggest thing, I guess. Budgets, it's hard to remember, but you know, back then probably
lots,
30
lots.
Or 40 million pounds, so really, yeah, you lots. Know, which back then was probably 100 million or close to in Australian and you know, 25 years ago, so yeah, really big budget, really cool. And then they had, you know, engine shop, gearbox shop, wiring, and all doing it at the absolute highest level. You know, it was DR is a very, very unique fellow and tremendously driven, always surround himself with really good structure, really good leadership. To this day, I think it was probably the best company I've ever worked for. Sort of uncompromising, but grew people, known for most of the people at that time had been there since around the start, and this, still I caught up with some people in the UK over Christmas, and I mean if they haven't gone very far, some are in F1 now, but still a lot of people that it's a little bit like 888 have been for a long time, where they grow people and the same people are still there for a very long time. They make it what it is. So it was huge and a really, really cool place to work.
So the development through the late 90s, you go to all these places with all these privateers and gentlemen rally drivers and whatever's going or whatever flight they put you on to where you go. But as it emerges later on, I think, was it 02 that you were Tommy Mäkinen's actual engineer by that stage? So you got to the point where you're working with one of the all-time greats of World Rally.
Yeah, so I went through, I did a couple of years in the customer team, and I think in late 99 I started doing I did one rally with Toshi Arai or somebody in the World Rally team when they did a third car, and then I think part of the way through 2000 I switched across and ran Marco Martin for the rest of that season. And also did some customer events still at that stage. And then 2001 was Marco. I did some events late in 2000 with Toshi Arai, actually for most of 2000. And then, 02 was Tommy. Tommy came on. Richard Burns left the team at the end of 01. And Tommy Mäkinen came on board. And the other engineer, Pierre, who I'm really, really great mates with still, he had chosen to engineer Petter Solberg when he came in the year before. I got Tommy, which was certainly a pretty interesting experience. I didn't really know much about Finnish, the Finn racing drivers in general, or Tommy for that matter. He was another, sort of a hero in a way, I guess, through rallying. He became my, I guess the rally hero when you see those guys,
because he'd been the World Rally champion and he'd been Mitsubishi's man for so long. So it was a big step for him to take the jump. But you talked about we've seen it with Kimi Räikkönen and we've seen it with other Finnish drivers and rally drivers. They've got a very chilled, relaxed way of going about it. They don't seem to sweat the small stuff. Was Tommy like that in your dealings with him? Were there any funny stories from along the way?
Oh my goodness. I don't know. Chilled and relaxed. They're not big on small talk or any of those. And I really hate to generalize, but sort of were briefed a little bit when we're working with the Finns, is they're not really, you don't really make eye contact as you're sort of walking along and say good morning very much. And they're very, very, a little bit different in their outlook. Kimi, I would say, from my experience of Finns, is actually a really outgoing Finn, Finnish rally driver. So, yeah, Tommy, he's mercurial and as a natural driver, just the most incredible guy, and tremendous success. But he was fiery and uncompromising and downright, he would get really angry or explosive, I guess, in some ways. Not just that was to whoever he worked with. It was a really interesting experience for me. I would say I'm a fairly expressive engineer and I like to work closely with drivers. Tommy and probably most Finns, I would say that's not the best mix. Someone like Petter, when we used to share the testing, myself and Pierre, the other engineer. So really it was just one engineer with the whole World Rally team for days and days of testing. And so, testing Petter, he was the same as me, just talk through problems, want to explore things and that kind of thing. Whereas Tommy was much more of just a solution, cut through the shit, like just wasn't interested in any of that sort of stuff, and it would almost sort of fire him up. So, it was a really interesting year for me. I learned a lot of Finnish swear words, many directed at me or others in the team and the group. I mean, he was an amazing guy. One of those fellows that you go through a lot during the work bit, and then you'd be out at the bar. I mean, absolutely a live wire. You know, just would be there at the bar and, you know, a Sunday night last, you know, and sometimes, you know, in daylight hours, still heading home, you know, he'd set off sometimes after recce when you had a little bit of time. Sorry, after the test, before recce, there was often no point going home on long haul events. And he'd set off and, you know, in Kenya off to Mombasa, which is where all of the sort of dens of iniquity were down on the coast, and sort of set up in a little gambling haven or something for a couple of days with his co-driver, and then come back and, this is also the Mitsubishi time, and win the rally. So yeah, he was a really unique, living on the edge sort of a guy. Not talking out of school, but one of the things I sort of found out later was that in the really successful time at Mitsubishi, they had a really good setup there, and Tommy was sort of a bit of a younger driver and would do anything that, you know, contributed to success. So they had a fellow there called Lassie Lampy, who was one of these coach type people. He hadn't been outright incredibly successful in his driving career, but he was just a brilliant setup guy, you know, just an amazing guy at getting the car working and everything else. So later on, we found, Tommy wouldn't really do an awful lot of testing at Mitsubishi. Lassie would do almost all of the testing, and Tommy would sort of pitch up, late in the test, just, you know, bit of an iron on an afternoon in the car, and then just win the rally, you know, and that was how that sort of worked. Incredibly fast, but later in the Mitsubishi era, when they went to the World Rally Car, which was, you know, sort of a failure all around, really, for various reasons. It just didn't work when Mitsubishi went to the World Rally Car. But Tommy, I think, then broke out onto his own way, as a lot of drivers do as they get older. They're not content with, you'd probably know a few of these names, but they're not content with just driving well. They start to get this feel of, like, I know how the car has to be, and I want to take the engineering of it this direction. And so Tommy was in that phase coming out of Mitsubishi, came across to Subaru, and I feel like I sort of copped the brunt of a bit of that. I mean, so did everybody, but, you know, he came in and had, you know, just so many ideas and really wanted to grab hold of, this is how we engineer the car, these are the ideas, you know. And so there were some really possibly spruce goose type things, you know, these ideas of ways that we're going to make the car faster. I think sort of got a bit involved with Pirelli as well on gravel and gravel tires. And yeah, a really interesting time, and probably derailed a lot of the test days. You know, we'd go with a 5-day test plan, you know, determined by all these people back there. And, you know, you'd sort of, start the test, and then Tommy would go, right, you know, we're going to do diff mapping, because they all really liked the diff mapping. You had sort of 50 diff maps or so on the thing, and some pots you could control them with, and then the, you know, me or whoever was there with the computer, you could program the maps however you want, you know. So if you touch the left brake, you know, you could, it loosened off the center diff, tightened up the rear, and so that was telling, you know, where they could use that as a trigger for the car to tuck in. We had some ABS, so we had tank steer, so many different things, and the drivers loved it. Even though really all you're doing is pushing, it's not really physics so much, because you're just apportioning where the drive goes. But I think all the drivers really loved it, because it was a real connection that was so tangible, and they could then control it on these little pots that were on the dashboard. Anyway, so Tommy had sort of usually just want to play around with that kind of thing. They got really, really focused Petter as well a little bit on, you know, loosening off the diffs, you know, taking the preload out of the diffs and things. So these test days sort of for a while really went nowhere, where they just, it's all he really wanted to do was these sort of, I don't know, what was considered certainly not getting ready for the rally, you know, because when you do rally tests, you need to, I mean, there's, you're trying to make technical breakthroughs, but it's more in that F1 way where we worked on physics. So something that's a gain, it's a time gain. And now what you have to do is go and prove that it'll do two rally distances and we can release it for the rally. And then, you know, you're in Argentina and you've got to make sure the car doesn't blow up the intake duct when you go through water splashes. And you're in Sweden, you've got to make sure that the new aero, or not new body package, doesn't catch the snowbanks and turn you around when they lean on them. And, you know, so there's an awful lot of just, you know, do detonation checks on the motor in all these different slip conditions. So with all these procedural things that just kept getting derailed. And I think I was sort of seen as, well, Phil, you're just going to have to really, you know, you're going to have to just be really firm with Tommy. And so I remember Lappy came out at one stage and Tommy, you know, just told him where to go. This is the first morning of the test, you know what I mean? And I mean, he's a fearsome guy, Tommy, really. You know, crossing over the line. I mean, you hear some of Kimmy's magic to the world race engineers in the F1, and sort of along those veins where it's, I mean, it's sort of demoralizing and cuts you down a fair bit the way they sort of treat the engineers and people around them. But yeah, so a bit of that. The only people really that Tommy would listen to was they have these sort of, it's called the Finnish Mafia. So they've got this system there for, I mean, all racing drivers in Finland. And they're sort of patrons, I guess, but kind of like investors as well. And that's how so many of them make it so far in motorsport, that they give them backing. And then on the backside of that, the earnings from their career, the driver's career, go back into the backers. So they've got a tremendous interest in it, and those are the sort of, they're a driver manager type guy that the driver absolutely listens to. You know, there's this real thing of respect there. But I think, you know, for the people in the English rally team, there wasn't so much of that. In fact, I remember one of my great mates, Tomo, was there with Tommy on one of the events, and Tommy was down in the car demanding that he came out and want to do some diff mapping, and Tom, I think, said, no, we've got to get on with the test plan. And Tommy came up, did a little flick turn and stopped next to the stairs of the truck and said, Tomo, get your fucking laptop. Ooh, actually, I don't know if I can swear on this, but and so Tomo came out and the team manager came out and said, no, we're not doing that. And so Tommy put in first and did this big turn and sprayed the whole truck and the catering and everything with gravel and then set off down the road. And that was quite a Tommy sort of a thing, you know. He was sort of had all the Pirelli guys stressed. And, yeah, so Tommy, I mean, that was like just an incredible year. I found it stressful the entire time because you just didn't know how to, you know, just didn't know how to sort of how to work with him. And I admit I probably wasn't the best person to sort of pacify him. I was young, really young, and, you know, in fairness, tiny bit out of my depth there. Hadn't been in rallying all that long. You had great people around you, but, you know, you have to deliver this information to those guys. And I think an older voice might have worked better. I mean, I remember another time we were on the Safari rally and we're in the lead of it, actually, Tommy was, and we got to the overnight break. And he had all these things about the dampers, sort of the feel of particular sets. So he kind of knew what set was in the car. He was one of those sort of guys, he'd be in there and adjusting them up by himself and playing around. And anyway, so he knew the damper set. And I had to tell him that, you know, I mean, it's just a decision made by the team, but the dampers are coming out, they're getting rebuilt, and another set's going in for tomorrow, you see. But it was known that this was a big issue because he really liked set three, or I don't know, whatever set that was at the time. Anyway, so I told him, we're sitting in the lunch thing, and I remember he sort of went a bit red, and then he picked up like a salt, like a glass salt shaker thing, and threw it at me, and I had to sort of duck my head, and it hit the truck right behind my head, and then, you know, that was that, and then it would be, you know, really be quite chummy, you know, really. No, I mean, actually, in that instance, the set that went in, I mean, nobody really knew, and the Prattle Damper guy had worked overnight, but he'd actually filled them with oil without, you know, it hadn't been bled up properly. No one really knew how that occurred, but basically went out with no suspension. And so I lost the rally. Didn't, you know, you send them out, they're gone for 50 Ks of the worst roads you can imagine. So we actually ended up out of the rally, and it was prophetic what he was doing, but it actually wasn't anything to do with the particular damp, you know, his like of that damp set. But yeah, a lot of those kinds of instances, but then some really, really fun times, you know, in sort of, I don't know, Argentina, and we had some great testing stuff we did in Germany, and some of these, you know, some of these other rallies. So yeah, it was a really incredible year.
It's always said, Phil, about, I know people who've worked in Formula One over the years have always said about how they loved coming to Adelaide or later Melbourne when the Grand Prix swapped as the one they really looked forward to on the calendar, where there was other events that, whether it was the location, whether it was the safety, whether it was other elements that they weren't so enamored with. What was the rally on the WRC Tour back in the day that was the one that everyone loved, and what was the one that nobody loved? Surely there's one at both ends of the spectrum.
Yeah, that's a really tricky one. I mean, Kenya back then, I was lucky enough, that was the last, I think that, well, they're back doing it now actually in a more abridged format, but Kenya was really, really cool because it was just, you know, you pitched up in Nairobi and it was semi-dangerous at that time, and then you'd set off, you know, out into the bush testing for a couple of weeks, and we didn't go in the helicopters in those days, but they still had chase helicopters. The roads were sort of open. Really fascinating sort of things. So, yeah, I'd say Kenya was probably one of those really memorable sort of events. Argentina, purely for the fans and the passion of everybody. You know, it's a really and a really unique place where we used to go down at Villa Carlos Paz, where the rally was based. Monte Carlo. The engineering challenges of it, and you know, it's another one of those really iconic rallies, and there's the stages if you're a rally buff. I mean, it's just still all those cool stages, Col de Torino and all these other ones. And I guess the technical challenge of Monte was so cool because you might have three different, you might have wet tarmac, dry tarmac, ice and snow in the one stage, and you had one set of tires, and you had these great matrices of, you know, you'd go testing on every type of road and run every single tire that you had, from slicks through to cut slick through to wets through to ice and snow tires. So you'd do a seconds per kilometre of every single tire on every single road type, and then try and sort of come up with the least bad option, I guess. Perth probably was the most fun event, I guess. Everybody, you know, not just being biased, but Perth was just a really great event when it was out there. It was just again iconic roads, but just really great atmosphere. So some of the lifestyle stuff was definitely a factor back in the day, because rallying was, you know, you traveled away for quite a long time. There were days of setup at the wherever you happened to turn up. You had to unpack containers and set up in a little temporary workshop, and then you went and did pre-event testing. I mean, often be away for 2 or 3 weeks. And then, you know, things like the lead up for the week was always quite good. Everybody was out, real camaraderie between the teams. And then the Sunday night was always a really good night too. So
social, you've got to be social. That's part of the enjoyment of all things motorsport. So we're at this stage at 2002. So we're 22 years ago here, by the way. We've still got a bit of ground to cover, just quietly. 2003, you come home to Australia. So I guess the first question that springs into my mind is why? You've made it to one of the top teams in world rallying. You're working with a world champion, albeit Tommy Macadam can be a little difficult to deal with at times, as you've outlined in some of those stories. Why'd you come home?
It's an interesting one, and one I don't know, you know, you go through these things at the time. And definitely Tommy, I would point out. I mean, I was, you know, quite happy there, and that wasn't a factor at all. I mean, it was adding to the interest of the whole thing, I guess, and the people I was working with were just, you know, amazing. So, you know, in hindsight, I look back and think, gosh, you know, I thought I was, I guess, a little bit I don't know about homesick or ready to go. I think everybody goes through these things where you imagine there's these great things going on back at home that you're missing out on. You know, everybody I knew seemed to be getting married, and I miss all the weddings and I missed all of those sorts of things. And I guess in, you know, when I think back, it probably wasn't the greatest decision. Although I've had no cause to look back on anything, I feel like I've been incredibly lucky. But, you know, to be honest, I was really poised there. I, you know, was, you know, in a great spot, in a, you know, really fantastic team. My wife, who I'd met over in the UK, well, my now wife, I'd met over in the UK, she was Canadian. She didn't have a visa and she wanted to go back to Canada to study. And so we did sort of a, you know, there was some factors there, I guess. But deep down, really, I guess I didn't think through it greatly. Even had some advice saying, man, just do some more time there. I mean, you're going to get home. It's a sort of advice I give people now, you know, no matter how much you think you're missing out on or how homesick you are, it's really not much happening at home particularly, and just sort of stay where you are a bit longer. So, yeah, another one of those moments, not overly well thought through, but, I mean, I knew enough and I did want to sort of come back to Australia. So I found myself heading back, and, I mean, Bondi pitched up again. Although, you know, in the end I sort of went along with Keys and back to Melbourne.
And there is where I'm going to hit the pause button on my chat with Phil Keed. So he's moved back to Australia and about to go into what turns out to be a two-decade-plus term in the V8 Supercars and then Supercars paddock. But it's there that we'll pick up the chat with part two. That's next time. Go and listen to any episodes in the back catalogue that you haven't listened to yet, and we'll have part two dropping very soon. I'm Aaron Noonan. Thanks for tuning in again. Send us your feedback via the form on our website, and I'll catch you next time with the V8 Sleuth Podcast, powered by Castrol.
Every lap in under a minute means every second matters. Bosch Power Tools Perth Super Sprint, May 17 to 19. Book now at Ticketek. Supercars, unforgettable.